Class by Louisiana Sea Grant to develop an oral history of the wetlands. We have not been told we have to look at A, B, C, D, and E.
Yeah, and understand we have no agenda. We're simply trying to record the history of the wetlands.
Yeah. No, I understand. No, well, I mean, I'm trying to understand. Okay.
And so here in Houma, we spent a lot of time with Louis Bloom, of Bloom and Bergeron. And
Mr. Louis was a very close personal friend. I helped Tommy get his book going. We were very close. Mr. Lewis's father, Tommy's grandfather, was my grandfather's closest friend.
Well, I don't...
They served on the town council together from 1933 to 1945. They actually, when they did this, the estate of Pierson Act, they did it jointly with the Blooms because they owned so much property together because they were all in the seafood business and next door to each other, across the bayou from each other. Very close friends, and down through four generations.
Well, and Lewis has just been marvelous. And Lewis and opened
very,
a door.
Very talented also.
Yes. Yeah. He opened a channel we'd never thought about, and that's through United Fruit Company. Mm-hmm. The United Fruit Company bringing bananas from Central America to New Orleans had to have something to go the other way. Mm-hmm. And we haven't found out the numbers, but there were barrels and barrels and barrels of dried shrimp, which they could rehydrate, add to rice, and it was a high protein, very nutritious element. So all of this is intertwined, and the reason we point that out is Carl and I are close. We're not quite there yet of having a text with photos and some video, but oral histories that we're going to condense and put in a kiosk. Tentatively, it'll be in the library here in Houma. Mm-hmm. Young people and others could come and listen to that. Now, our goal is to get 10 or 12 of these.
But the kiosk idea, and the fact there are kiosks like this throughout the country, and it's something that you can update remotely. So in other words, mm-hmm. Sea Grant office in Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. As we develop these different components or modules for public consumption, can be downloaded onto these machines so that it can start off with dried shrimp, but it can also contain later components for the oyster industry, for trapping, for mm-hmm. cattle industry, for all aspects of coastal life.
And right now, Carl and I are retired, so we are doing this just for the passion.
You like me. I'm semi-retired working my butt off.
You need to talk to my wife. She says something similar to say that about me.
But you know, my father-in-law told me, and he warned me just before I retired, that he had never been as busy as when he retired. And unfortunately, that has proved to be prophetic.
That is very, very prophetic.
And then what Carl and I are going to do over the next 5 months is we've got to go to foundations and look for donations into the LSU Foundation that will allow us to buy the kiosk, that will allow mm-hmm. us... The key, Chris, is that if we scan any photo in this book, and we're going to transfer that to a digital archive. Well, Carl and I did the work of getting the photo. Mm-hmm. Behind the scenes is a full-time librarians mm-hmm. who have to give, this is from, it could be Chris Sinek, or you may want Chris Sinek and your wife's name, family.
Oh,
you understand?
Yes, okay. I know.
Well, he's in the, he left his ears in it now.
So we are looking to underwrite the cost of... Yeah. A couple of graduate students, and we'll get it. It's slow, well, meticulous. Right now, we're here to interview.
I'm going to give you something, and I don't know how much you know about this, but it's one of the fascinating stories of dried shrimp industry in the 30s when, after World War I and the restrictions on Germany, that Bloom and Bergeron sent tons and tons of dried shrimp and ground shrimp meal to Germany so that they could get the nitrogen out for munitions. And not too many people know that.
No.
But I know that.
Yeah.
That's a fabulous story. And it was all under the table, or, you know, around the rule and whatever. So I mean, it's it just goes to show you what certain people can do to be innovative, I guess is a good word.
Yeah, there's, I mean, Louis Bloom brought out a letter that was from one of his Chinese, let's call him supplier, he may have been an employee.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very nice and very complimentary and how much he enjoyed Louisiana. He named one son Louisiana and one son Terrebonne. And the thing that's intriguing to us is that there's one book written about the Chinese in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
It's all related to plantation agriculture. Mm-hmm. There's not even a sentence about the Chinese influence in the shrimp drying business. And that's where we become very keen on talking to people who can relate these stories.
Yeah.
So that's the project. I mean, it's a project that has no end, really. No beginning, it's just find somebody and interview.
The problem you have, and I already know exist, is the people that you need to talk to are no longer here.
Yes.
That's problem number one, and that's why I did what I did. I started my project. I was fortunate enough because of my father was a surgeon, and we had a large family. And he was a general surgeon, meaning he did your eyes, he did your ears, he did delivered your babies, he fixed your bones, he did everything. There were only two types of physicians, surgery physicians and non-surgeons. And he was the first board-certified surgeon in South Louisiana. And after World War II, Hill Burton funds became available, like the GI Bill, so that every community could have a community hospital. Well, to be on that, to build a hospital in your community, you had to have a board certified surgeon, pathologist, anesthesiologist, and internist. So my father, because he was on the staff in general surgery at LSU, he was the head of colorectal surgery, and they wanted him to stay and be head of the chairman, head and chairman of the Department of Surgery, and he wanted to come home. So he had that relationship with the university. So the Ellenders had the Ellender Clinic here, but they were not really surgeons, if you will, board certified at all. Sort of on-the-job training. Dr. Willett had some surgical training. A little family clinic, the first hospital in Houma, Dr. Prentice Parker had in 1924 to 1928, and he left. And then around 1928, 1929, they had the Ellender Clinic. About 1938, 1939, the Ellender Clinic. But it was a little private clinic. So my father, with the help of board-certified physicians on the LSU staff, opened Terrebonne General Hospital, St. Joseph in Thibodaux, St. Anne's in Raceland, Lady of the Sea in Galliano, and Lakewood in Morgan City. And every Saturday, he had to get in his car and go to different hospitals to sign all the charts, because there were doctors practicing in those communities who were on the staff, but all the paperwork had to be signed by board-certified people. And he got Dr. Gordon McHardy from Brown McHardy Clinic, head of the internal medicine department at LSU, Dr. Nothica, and other physicians like that who were professors to be on the visiting staff, and that's how they got around the board certification issue. So my father had a great love for his community and his family, and he was talented in that he knew everybody. If you came to see him, he would say, "Don, how you doing? And how's Teresa's cousin?" And this and that. And everybody knew everybody. Mm. Houma was a small town. Very briefly, when I went to LSU on an academic and athletic scholarship. So when I got to LSU, 1964, I had never paid for anything. If I needed a shirt, I just went to DuPont's. If I needed some shoes, I went to Sadie's or what have you. And if I needed a tie, I just went to get my tie, and that was it. Because we were a very small town. Didn't see my first hamburger till I was a sophomore in high school, 1960-61 probably. Got to LSU, and my father had, he was head of the trust department at the bank, and my aunt, who just had a 95th birthday, was head of the bookkeeping department. I had to go to the bank and say, "I'm going to give you a checkbook. And you'll be able to write a check when you need some money at LSU in Baton Rouge." I said, "Okay." So I played football, so I had an athletic card. I didn't have to register for anything. I didn't have to pay for anything. So when I ran out of money, I realized I had to go write a check. So we were at the bingo on the
Nicholson.
Nicholson. And I gave my checkbook to the bartender. His name was Lonnie. I said, "Lonnie, you got to write a check." I said, "Why?" I said, "Well, I'm out of money. I need some money." So he wrote my first check for me, the bartender at the bingo. And it was a small town. We were a very small town. And when I got to LSU, I thought the way those guys from Bunky were talking about, I thought that was a big place. You know, they were very proud of that, Bunky and Marksville and all that. I thought that must be a hell of a big place, you know? Well, until I finally went to Bunky and Marksville, I said, "Well, I'm from the big place, you know?" Different kind of people, you know what I mean? Like I would say, they're a little braggadocious. I mean, my idea of what Bunky and Marksville was almost like Shreveport, I guess. But so I inherited a lot of his enthusiasm for family history. Then I realized I have 8 grandchildren now, who have no concept at all. The oldest one's 10. My birthday's Sunday, Halloween. Has no concept at all of where she's living. Her mother's from Atlanta, Georgia, who's a dentist. She really has no concept. She's been here for, you know, 8 or 10 years now. Went to LSU, became a dentist from Atlanta. Is living in Houma, Louisiana. I sort of just decided that if I didn't do it, and I'm the last member of I'm a fourth generation, I'm probably the only one that still speaks French, that has the time and the finances to get this down. So that's why I started. And I really just wanted to get a genealogical type situation, because I told you that the original Pearson Act came here, 1860. It was a wilderness area. He and Mr. Jean-Marie Dupont, who's from Binac, France, which is very near Cignac and Lourdes and Barbizon, came and had a grocery store and a baker shop. Incidentally, I have the oldest picture of downtown Houma, 1866. It's the oldest known picture. It's pretty interesting. There were just, I believe, 24 buildings in the whole community. Half of them were ballrooms, but and doctors and lawyers' offices. I don't have too much else, but and incidentally, my Uncle Donald, who's 90, told me when he was a little boy they used to walk to church. And on Main Street, there was a Chinese family that did all the laundry services. And I have never heard of a, mm-hmm. a Chinese family at that time, now this is 1900, in Houma, other than the people associated on the shrimp drying platform. And there were not too many in Houma, mostly in Barataria. Jack Chung was here, though. He was here in the St. Martins, with the St. Martins and the Blooms. But that's the only Chinese person I know in that era. He had, and my Uncle Donald can tell you about it, he had a laundry on Main Street. But I lost my train of thought somewhat, but I realized that if I didn't get it down, it was never going to get done. I had no idea at all the magnitude of the task that I had chosen to complete. It was a 10-year stretch that we're just finishing 10 years, and three trips to visit my family in France. We still have a large family in France. I got a phone call yesterday from a cousin that found out about, and I've spoken to her several times, invited me to her 85th birthday party in Kansas City. I got another call day before yesterday from another cousin in Phoenix, who's sending me a picture of her grandmother. And this, we have such a large extended family. It's been absolutely amazing. I mean, it's just, it's absolutely amazing.
Well, while you're on the subject of your family in France, this is something that I think is of general interest to people who study immigration in Louisiana, particularly because the foreign French here mm-hmm. had such an important impact. Mm-hmm. How long did your family maintain contacts with relatives in the old country?
We have letters, and if you read the text...
Right, but I'm trying to
get it on here. Oh, you're trying to get it on here, okay. Well, first of all, I think, and I did not realize it at the time, that I have probably in my possession, meaning when I say me, I mean my family, we have in possession some things that most families never would not possess today, including his two passports, his foreign passport, which allowed him to go to a foreign country, and the passeport étranger, and his working visa, so he could travel within the confines of France during the Napoleonic Wars and practice his trade.
That was your dad?
My great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather, okay.
I have all his passports and his visas. Have his boarding pass, passenger list, picture of the vessel to Texas. What was on board? Where I have a picture of the port the same month of Bordeaux that he left. We have not his, but a similar diary of the two-month journey to New Orleans. We have when the weather of the day when he got to the mouth of the river, from the Daily Crescent newspaper, the Marine Report. We have all the documents of the ship owned by the Wakeman family in New York City. I got that out of the National Archives in Washington, D.C. It's called an enrollment, which we today would call a survey. I have copies of the newspapers of the day. The three boats that were tied up at the mouth of the river with him, the captains of those vessels, the tug that went to get him, how long it took to get to New Orleans, where they docked. He docked in Algiers at a certain dock, and I have that information. One of the other boats was across in the New Orleans side. But and then we have his documents when he came to Terrebonne. I have all of his acquisitions and purchases. I have his naturalization papers. I have his wine glasses that he brought from France with the coat of arms. I have his birth certificate from France. I have photographed all of the home sites, stood on his home site. I visited with all my cousins in France. I communicate with them regularly. Relative to France, my family lives very close to Lourdes. And if you read Franz Werfel's book, Song of Bernadette, written in 1940s, it talks about Saint Bernadette was interviewed by the church hierarchy and the political hierarchy about her visions in this Cenac house in Lourdes. And the house is still there. My family members still volunteer there. And it's pretty interesting that he grew up with Saint Bernadette. He was born in 38, she was born in 42. And they lived just a mile or so, 2 miles apart. And I think that a few years later, when you get close to the 1850s, when she had her visions, thousands and thousands of Europeans descended upon Lourdes. And I think for the first time, those peasants and High Pyrenees who were sort of isolated saw what was happening. There were other people coming, a lot of things going back and forth. And I think that's one of the things, along with the odium, or the disease of the vines that decimated the grape industry, I think that's one of the things in combination with the war. If you take those three things, there was a lot of incentive for the Français étrangers to leave, foreign French. It's still beyond me why somebody 22 years of age would get on a boat 115 foot long and take 2 months to cross over to go somewhere where he only heard about. And there are a lot of reasons he wound up in Louisiana, as you know, but...
Do you have any of, sometimes these are called immigrant letters?
Oh, wait, I was going to get to that. So he got here, okay? I was trying to answer his question
first.
No,
we're fine.
Yeah, he got here, and the first letter we have is his brother wrote to a friend in St. Charles Parish. His brother was Jean, have you seen Jean-Pierre? He says, I haven't seen him lately. I've been told that he went into the country, which obviously was Terrebonne or the Lafourche interior. And unfortunately, from that letter on, we don't have any evidence of that. We know there were communications because that information has been confirmed on the other side of the family in France. They apparently knew more about us than... That was my biggest impression was when I got to France for the first time, is they knew more about us over here than I knew about them over there. But from a physical standpoint, we don't have any other letters until he died. When he died, we do have confirmation that his youngest son, the 13th of the 14 children, Dennis, had his father's papers, which included his passports, his letters, his wine glasses, and correspondence with his brothers. We've recovered all of that but the letter. But we do know they existed. So, and that's another thing. His passport, which he obtained in 1858, you can see his, he was literate, because you can see his handwriting, which is somewhat unusual. Mm-hmm. What also is of interest is that he came to French-speaking Louisiana, obviously, with his Basque origins, and was elected to the first school board in 1888. And we have his certificate signed by Governor Murphy J. Foster, the recent governor's great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of papers after he got here where you can see he adapted and knew English and could read and write. And his children were so schooled. Also, and that's an unusual thing for people from that heritage. Would you agree with me? The other interesting story, if you look at the history of this particular individual and others like him, his two brothers were in the service, Napoleon's service. He was drafted. We have his draft notice. We have his deferment letter because he had two brothers in the service. I have a letter written by the mayor of his town saying that he was of good character and not wanted for any problems when he was applying for his passport. I have the letter written by the prefect of Gironde, more or less the sheriff of the area, in the Bordeaux area, saying that he wasn't needed for military service so he could get a passport. So we have all that. And he left France during the war, Emperor Napoleon III's war, and set off for the United States. October 24th, I think, 1860. And when he landed at the mouth of the river, December 20th, 1860, South Carolina seceded from the Union. And 4 days later, on Christmas Eve, 1860, he got to New Orleans, and they were having secession parades. And before he got to Homer, around probably April of 1861, Louisiana became a sovereign nation, and then subsequently joined the Confederacy in March. So he went from a Napoleonic war headed for the United States, wound up in the Civil War, and when he died, 1914, his seven of his boys were registered for service in World War I, and maybe 20 or so of his grandsons were back in France fighting World War I. Some got wounded. And I think that's a hell of a story. The other thing I think that's important is that these French people, and they were high mountain people, came to Louisiana and adapted. High mountain, snow-capped peaks, lowlands, mosquitoes, snakes, alligators.
A study in contrast.
Et cetera, and they adapted. And Carl, I think the French language was the common reason that they were able to get together and make plans and adapt over time, if you will. But they adapted and changed with every one of the major events that occurred to the new location down here. and they adapted it initially from high mountains to lowlands. They carved out the wilderness. They settled the area. They raised their families. And they were sustenance people. They grew and raised everything that they ate and wore. As technology improved, they adapted to that. They they adapted to the beginning of the seafood industry as an economic backbone of this whole Southeast Louisiana, with the technology of ice, electricity, light, engines, and they made that transfer from sail power to motor power, from local consumption of seafood to marketing seafood, using the railroad, taking the technology that was developed in Baltimore in the 1850s, which originally came from France. And that's a fascinating story. Do you know the story of a can?
We know a little bit of it, but please.
Okay.
Please.
Le Monde, M-O-N-D-E, is the big newspaper in Paris. Napoleon III had a very famous statement: an army marches on its stomach. It's a true statement. The wars in those days did not occur in the winter, or battles, I should say, did not occur in the winter. They occurred in the warm months when food was available. So he said, well, you know, I can only go so far because I got to feed my army. I need a way to bring food with me so I can keep going and the other army can't. So Le Monde, at his insistence, put an ad out, I think for 10,000 francs. If somebody can come up with a device that we can put food in and it'll be good and edible, you get this award. Well, this guy came up with an idea of a can. So that's how they made the first can, and he won the award. It was made by hand. But they didn't quite have the product. They didn't know they knew about spoilage, but they didn't know how and why. And in 1860, Louis Pasteur came across the answer, pasteurization. And that from that can and heat and pasteurization process, and subsequently under pressure and a few other developments, they were able to can food and preserve it, all in the interest of the military, for the army to march on a full stomach. Well, that fella sold some of that information to a fellow from England, Kinsley, and he went to New York. He brought the process to New York, and they were using, still made by hand. And then about the 1860s, it wound up in the Baltimore, Chesapeake area, and they began to can corn and seafood, first place in the United States that they did that.
Well, if I can interrupt you, I have a quick question for you with your medical background. These cans originally were soldered.
Right.
So what effect did the solder have on the contents, the food contained in the cans?
I would think a deleterious effect. I'm no metallurgist, but I don't think it was very good. Similar to lead poisoning today, probably.
Okay, well, that's a question that's something that's never come up.
I don't think it would have been a good thing. So with the Chesapeake estuary so bountiful, if you will, they realized that all they had to do was go get the oyster and then put it in a can. And of course, after the Civil War, they had rail in that area. We didn't have any, but they did. They didn't have ice, but they could take ice from the Great Lakes, which I think is an interesting story too. There were actually ice barns here in Houma. And they floated ice from the Great Lakes down the Mississippi River. And that guy became the first millionaire in the United States, first industrial millionaire. It's a hell of a story, but of course in New Orleans, they did the first commercial production of ice in the 1860s, 1870s, and they finally got that process going. So with ice and the westward expansion, the first fast food in the nation was the oyster. Because all you had to pick it up, you didn't have to grow it. You could pick it up, it was protein. And it was the scourge of the day, oyster taverns and oyster saloons. And what's interesting with that, in 1860s is when Tabasco started. And the McElhenney family has some correspondence where they were promoting the use of Tabasco on the seafood. So they sort of rode the back of the oyster to get national recognition. And they promoted things like one drop, two drops, and what happened, and they had this documented, somebody put a cup, and put the oyster in a cup and ate it, and it made the news because it blistered his tongue. So Tabasco rode the back of the oyster west. And the use of Tabasco and the invention of cocktail sauce was to hide the smell of the seafood. The further west you went, the less refrigeration you had. And I thought that's a fabulous story too. So if you look at the history of Tabasco and you see how oysters got started, everything was great until the late 1880s, when you started to have pollution problems on the East Coast. Too many people, they were running out of seafood because they were not replanting the reefs they were harvesting, but there was no, what's the word I want to use? There was no replenishment of the reefs. Same thing happened in South Louisiana, in Plaquemines, in St. Bernard. At the same time, the oyster industry was relegated just to New Orleans, because they could go upriver and sell them in the city. There was no oyster industry south of New Orleans. Local consumption, but no industry, or no economy, if you will. So a person got sick in New York, and in Chicago they had typhoid Mary. And typhoid is transmitted via unclean practices and sewage and contaminated water. And so somebody said they got typhoid fever from eating a raw oyster. So it pretty much decimated the industry at that time. So some individuals in Baltimore saw that they were going to, because of also the depleting resources, unwise harvesting practices, etc., they headed south to Virgin Territory, Mississippi Gulf Coast, Florida Gulf Coast, and not so much Louisiana at the time. And that's because we had no infrastructure, railroad, etc. And by the 1900s, the oyster industry had declined significantly in the Chesapeake Bay area, and the new fast food for the population, because it was very populated, was a hot dog, Coney Island. So oyster saloons' popularity went down, and hot dogs went up. And that sort of ruined that whole industry. They moved here, Gulf Coast, eventually the Croatians in Plaquemines Parish and in St. Bernard had decimated the reefs on that side of the river. There was no active economy in west of the Mississippi River. I'm talking about fishing wise. So they started coming over here. So that made them form the Oyster Commission, which is the forerunner of the present day wildlife and fisheries. And then before that, Conservation Department. While they were having oyster wars in the Chesapeake Bay between Maryland and Virginia, they were having wars, actually, boats, and they had a navy. Each state had a navy to protect their reefs. They formed the Oyster Commission, and they first failed attempt to regulate the industry or protect the reefs was parish-wide, parish control, and that didn't work, so the state took over, and they actually built 4 gunboats, and thank you for the picture of one of those in your book, Don. And they started protecting the reefs locally. And by that time, hey Christopher, I'll be right with you, bud. By that time, the first incorporated seafood business that we know of south of New Orleans in this area was Homer Fish and Oyster, 1891. And that story is all documented in the book. Tofio Sanak was the sixth child of the original Sanak children. And his brothers and brothers-in-laws were all living in Dulac, because Dulac, in 1860, when Jean-Pierre Sanak got to Lower Lafourche, or what we call now Terrebonne, it was a wilderness area, and the majority of the people lived in Dulac, Louisiana, because that's the natural port. The largest community was in Dulac. Second largest was Shreveport and Gibson, because in the 1850s, the railroad came through there. Tigerville, if you will, and Thibodeauville, Shreveport. So, Mr. Morgan had, of the Morgan Steamship Company and his association with the Vanderbilts, had the steamships and the railroad. There were a couple of individuals in Morgan City that were harvesting oysters and putting them on the steamships, because you could ride the train from New Orleans to Morgan City, Brazier, but you had to take the boat to Texas. So they were selling seafood, oysters in particular, because all you had to do was keep them wet. You didn't have to have any ice. And they were good for a few days. And the Sanak brothers were sailing with luggers, oysters from their reefs, to sell in Morgan City and buy goods from the end of the train, end of the road at the end of the train. But you could get things in Morgan City that you could get in New Orleans without having to go to New Orleans. So they were bringing oysters to Morgan City. And then from Morgan City, they come back with groceries to in the store they had in Dulac. And Tofio was actually eventually lived in Morgan City, bought property and married a girl from Morgan City. And when they decided to start Homer Fish and Oyster Company, there were 16 individuals decided to start the seafood business. They started it in 1891. It went under. In 1893, they incorporated it. Tofio Sinag came in and took over, managed it, and put it on his feet. And then by 1896, his brother, Jean Charles, started C. Sinag and Company, and they jointly began the what we consider the modern seafood business here in Terrebonne. And it all started, when there was a transition from sale to mechanization. We had refrigeration, we had electricity, and we had communication and transportation. Communication via telegraph on the railroad. Now the spur from Shreveport to the outskirts of Homer occurred in 1872. So things were really just beginning. I actually have a picture of the first phone page in Terrebonne, which includes numbers 1, 2, through about 26, I believe. Homer Fish and Oyster was number 3. So all that came together at the turn of the century. And we had the wonderful resources on our coast. And to this day, still number 1. And the brothers put together the backbone of the economy to come in Terrebonne and Lafourche and St. Mary, or Southeast Louisiana, if you will. And up until the 40s, the early 40s, from 1900 to 1940, the backbone of the economy in this area was seafood. Oysters initially. Mm-hmm. In the late 20s, with the advent of the seine and motor power, I mean not the seine, the trawl, and motor power, which really didn't get going until the early 30s, shrimp, and we had all the other associated things, moss, frogs, market hunting, crab meat in the early 1900s, mostly in Morgan City, not so much in Terrebonne. There were 7 or 8 places where they were producing crab meat in 1910 or so in St. Mary Parish. But this area rode the first 40 years of 20th century on the back of the oyster and the shrimp.
Well, while we're at that point, if I can ask a question.
You can. I interrupt you to ask a question at this point.
Homer had some of the biggest canneries in the United States.
Biggest what?
Canneries in the United States at this time. Was your family involved?
No. Okay, my family was in the packing. Mm-hmm. Lake Fishing, no. Dr. Jastrzemski had his Lake Oyster and Lake Oyster Packing Company. I have to go look it up. I can't say it right now. Anyway, it's right where the high rise is on by Terrebonne. Believe it or not, was the when you talk about canning, remember I said Baltimore, they had to can, and they were the first people to do corn and seafood. And what that did, that meant that it was seasonal. So you had to adapt the process so that you could work year-round. They had seafood in the winter, and they had vegetables in the summer. And they brought that down here. And the largest pumpkin canning facility in the world was right here in Houma, Dr. Jeff Skrimsky's. And I actually have wooden barges in Bioterrebonne full of pumpkins right here in Houma. The canning process is later on than we're talking about packing and shipping fresh oysters. That was a little later. And of course it goes hand in hand with the quote Bohemians, the Eastern European people from the Baltimore area. We had over 1,000 of those individuals working here in the canning business in the early 1900s who were living here. And that's documented. The Cenac family were planters, packers, and shippers of raw fish and seafood. We were not in the shrimp business. There was no shrimp business then when we started.
Let me interrupt just quickly. How many, let's start pre-mechanization, oyster luggers did the family have?
Who? I tell you what, let's go off the record for a second.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, sure.
I have not read the manuscript.
No.
Now let me tell you what I'm going to ask you to do for me. The manuscript is the best I could do to give a condensed version of all the things that I've just been showing you. And I'd love to talk into the thing for you, okay? And I'll tell you all the stories I know. It's not a problem. But I think if you read the manuscript, you could get an idea of what you want to ask me.
Okay. Sure.
Is that fair enough?
Oh, that's,
would
that's
you agree?
Sure.
So,
I have the manuscript. I'll forward it to him.
I mean, don't you think that...
Oh, yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, a question out of the dark. I mean, I'm going to start going this direction. And, you know, I mean, I can go on and on and on.
No, you should. The more... and look at it this way. You are the keeper of your family history.
I realize that.
Eight grandchildren. Whatever is captured on tape and that we provide for you, it only takes one of them to begin to listen and hear the family record, and that becomes very important.
Of course, the thing is, they'll probably be 40 years old before they
listen, if you got Glenn tapes when he started in Houma, family history, my Aunt Rita Mae is in there, and I have her. You can get it at the library.
Yeah,
I have this separate one from my Aunt Rita Mae, my daddy's sister, who also was in the historic saving type stuff.
Let me interrupt just a moment. Carl and I have a handshake agreement with the library, and they are giving us on loan their tapes.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking them to LSU and taking the tapes and put them in digital format. Protect the tapes.
That'd be wonderful.
And we're providing it back to the library just as a service.
Mm-hmm.
It's a slow process. Carl speaks French. We've still got to get some people.
And about two-thirds of them are in French.
Yeah, and that's been a bit of
a
problem.
It's hard to understand for me.
Yeah.
By the way, my patient, he's from France, and from Marseille. I see all the French-speaking people down here, too. Because I'm really, it's a lost thing, you know.
But we're working with that collection. It'll take us probably about 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
We have some students that can transcribe the English.
Well, another thing, too.
My name is Rita Mae Hoffman, Hoffman family from Thibodeau.
Mm-hmm. Johnny Hoffman.
Well, Hoffman Music, the bank, Mr. Hoffman's president of the bank there, was married to my Aunt Rita Mae. And she is 97 right now, but she's Alzheimer's, no. But
well, we learned some painful lessons back in 2005. We lost a wealth of artifacts and other historical documents. Family collections just disappeared overnight. So that's why we're scrambling to back to get as much as we can on tape or in digital form and store it off-site in safer places.
Well,
these are going to be in two university repositories and also hopefully in Washington, D.C.
I told Carl, I started on this thing as a genealogical thing just to identify and put together some of my family artifacts. Tommy brought me to see Cliff, and that's and Tommy was pushing. I actually was sitting on a side of his bed when he died. I lost my best friend, but anyway, I had an artificial shoulder replacement. I was in the hospital in Houston, and he called me from the hospital in Austin. He said, "How you doing?" I said, "Fine." He said, "Where are you?" He says, "I'm in the hospital in Austin." I said, "What are you doing over there?" He said, "My urine changed colors. My wife got upset, so she brought me to the emergency room, and they sent
good
me
morning.
Here."
Good morning.
Don Davis.
I'm Don Davis. Good day.
Very nice to meet you.
And this is Carl Brasso.
Nice to meet you too.
Please have a seat.
Thank you.
And he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer while I was in the hospital in Houston. That's how close friends we were. But from that little undertaking, it has emerged into a monster. And as you know, we've been talking about it. And it has allowed, because of where I was in my life and professional activities, and I had time to do it, et cetera, et cetera. I never could have done this 20 years ago. And I want to do it, and it's done now. Now we're in the trying to preserve it, okay? And it's very, very important to me that gets done. It's really my number one goal that I want to do in my life. Now, and I really want to participate with y'all to give you the benefit of all the stuff I got up here. This lady sitting here, because I have a story, I have it here, but I can't write it down. And you're talking about a coincidence. Jean-Pierre Sonnac married Victorine Fungi, who was of Acadian origin, predated their family has Spanish land grants from Carondelet on Grand Cayo and Little Cayo. She was number 12 of 12 children.
Pierre's wife.
And he married Victorine Fungi. Claire's great-grandmother. No.
She was
your great-grandmother's sister.
She was an aunt to my domain grandmother. She was a Fungi.
Well, anyway, we cousins. But we went to high school together. That's a picture of Claire. Go look
ago.
At that, Carl. read that last thing. Y'all read that one, Don. That's.
I can't. I gotta get where I can see.
Okay.
That one. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Y'all know Joe Broussard and Thibodeau. I mean, in Lafayette.
Joe Broussard,
the head of all catering at USL and the Cajun Dome.
This is what he's trying to point out to y'all. That he was, and I was the queen. He was the captain of the court, and now he's all involved in the that's what he was saying.
Well, Joe Broussard is one of our emeritus officers in the Washington crew, and he's married to a girl that went to school with us, and they live in Lafayette, so she dug up all of that out of our high school yearbook
and
sent that to me.
You know what's wrong?
Linda Vincent.
Oh, Linda, yeah, okay.
That's me right here in the top corner. Mm-hmm. The Sugar Bowl of 1964, so that was a few years ago too. But anyway, I have a story. I've been wanting to tell it. It's hard to get people to listen to you because they're interested in it. My wife gets mad at me because she says you ramble on and on and on and on, but I have a lot to tell.
Don and I wouldn't know anything about that.
Not familiar at all, are you?
You know, at a point in this, I think if you asked me that question, I'd probably have to take my fifth.